You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on February 17th, 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, President Barack Obama insists that it says right there in the Constitution that he's allowed to nominate a new Supreme Court justice. The Republican Party seems ready to insist that it doesn't. China parks anti-aircraft missiles on a disputed island and insists that it's really no big deal. Every other country in the vicinity begs to differ. Italy puts same-sex civil unions in the too-hard basket, at least for now, and quite possibly for some while to come. A Russian footballer ventures diplomatically offside in Turkey, and New York ponders the difference between an ugly old building and a venerated landmark. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And you are welcome to the programme. My guests today are, once again, Isabel Hilton, CEO of China Dialogue, and James Boyes, historian and author, most recently, of Hillary Rising. Welcome both. We will start tonight in Washington, where, not for the first time, the Republican Party is either having or affecting great difficulty understanding how the Constitution of the United States works, or indeed getting on board with the idea that the president remains the president until he ceases being president. At issue is a replacement for Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, whose dogged, decades-long struggle against social progress ended with his death last week. President Obama says the Constitution is pretty clear about what happens next. The GOP seems to be preparing to beg to differ. James, first of all, this is a strange judgment for the Republican Party to have to make, isn't it? Because Obama's still president for quite a long time. I've looked this up. The longest it's ever taken to confirm a Supreme Court justice has been 125 days to get Louis Brandeis up to the gate under Woodrow Wilson. Two justices confirmed under Obama, Kagan and Sotomayor, 87 and 66 days. There is plenty of time. The Republicans are being ridiculous, aren't they?
Time aplenty, and they are really digging themselves a deep, deep, deep hole here. There are several ways that if you're a Republican, you could stop a nomination by Barack Obama quite legally, openly, and without having to put yourself in this position of being quite so obstructionist. Because, as the Constitution says, and the President will remind everybody who listens, the President nominates, and the Senate has to then hold hearings and offer advice and consent, which, in other words, is an opportunity for a good slanging match. And usually the president will get his way and get someone he wants appointed to the bench. There have been exceptions, and to be fair, Democrats have in the past rejected Republican nominees, such as Robert Bork, for example, and that's quite legal. There is not a rubber stamp requirement here by the Senate. But they are required to actually comply by the Constitution and hold hearings. And they don't need to be being so bloody-minded, quite frankly, by saying, we're not going to hold hearings. It's ludicrous. Hold the hearings, and if you don't approve of what the president puts forward, or you want to make this into a political football, deny him and make and then put the ball back into Obama's court and prove why he should be allowed to put this person on the bench. But hold hearings.
Isabel, I can't figure out whether there's actually a coherent strategy underpinning the Republicans muttering that they might not even hold hearings, or whether this is now just reflex to them, that if there's anything they can do to obstruct things, to screw things up, to get in the way, they'll just do it without necessarily thinking of the rights and wrongs or indeed the consequences.
Well, I appreciate the courage that you show in looking for a coherent strategy amongst the Republicans, but I think there hasn't really been one for quite a while. We've got, I mean, it is a bit of a mess, and I think there is a lot of reflex here amongst those who say we won't hold hearings, which, as James says, is completely off the wall. And I think that you did notice some disquiet amongst Republicans that at this time, this could result in people thinking that somehow they weren't quite cooperating as they should. You know, there is a public duty to obey the Constitution. And there are, as we've heard, perfectly good opportunities to mess about with the nomination. But messing about with the Constitution, it's not too smart. And there are many, many examples of Supreme Court justices confirmed in the last year of a president's office. It's not like he's leaving tomorrow.
But James, is there a, looking at it from the Republicans' point of view, which is always fun to do, Is there a possibility here they could shoot themselves in the foot? Mm-hmm. Let's say they do just refuse to participate, refuse to hold hearings, with the result that the choice does get punted to the next president. If the next president is Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, they might end up with somebody they really don't want on the bench.
It's like you've been reading my tweets. Absolutely, yes. And I suggested this exactly. You know, the candidates have been saying, Cruz and Rubio and Trump, the next president must decide this, on the understanding that it will be them. But there's a 50-50 chance that it won't be. And if it is Hillary Clinton, there's nothing to stop her nominating
Barack Obama.
She's just taking it straight out of my mouth. Absolutely. Nothing to stop her nominating him to be the next Supreme Court Justice, effectively. So it's a remarkable situation. They really should play ball and get Obama. Let's be honest about it. He knows he's not going to get a radical left-wing firebrand on to the Supreme Court with the current makeup of Congress. He's going to need to put someone forward who is, you know, relatively... you know, centrist, you know, someone who's liberal, but enough that he can quantifiably get it through a Republican-controlled Senate. They're far better playing ball now with a relatively lame duck-ish Barack Obama than a brand new, newly minted Democrat with all the political capital and with a potential. Don't forget, the Senate's up for a third of its re-election. Who's to say that the Democrats won't control the Senate come the new campaign season coming up in 2017? So, yes, they should really try and play ball now rather than punt and really risk the farm in the new year.
Just a final thought on this from you, Isabel. And again, let's just for fun try and suggest that there's any coherent planning behind the Republican Party's reaction to this. Is there an argument that actually showing up and being good sports about this might actually be to their electoral advantage? They've got people running for president. It's a pretty big year. If they turn up and say, look, we may have our disagreements with the current inhabitant of the White House, but we recognise that this is the luck of the draw with the Supreme Court justices. We will hold fair and reasonable hearings, etc., etc., because we are good citizens.
Well, I think there's a great advantage there. And I think that's the root of the disquiet that you hear within the Republican Party about this refusal to follow the procedures. I think one of the problems with this section of the Republican Party is that they've made the fatal error of believing their own propaganda, and they may well, you know, think that the country is with them on this. I would doubt it.
Okay, well, let's look now at the South China Sea. It's a part of the world about which I did all my best choppy diplomatic waters metaphors yesterday, unfortunately, and that was before China decided to park a surface-to-air missile system on one of the region's bewildering quantity of hotly disputed islands. China appears to have deployed anti-aircraft batteries on Woody Island. It's part of the Paracels chain, also claimed by Vietnam and Taiwan, the latter of which is itself, of course, also claimed by China. Isabel, this is your specialist area. China, we did a big thing yesterday on China's delectable diplomatic passive-aggressive offer you can't refuse diplomatic language, specifically in reaction in relation to Australia. In this particular instance, China says that, well, China seems to suggesting even if the anti-aircraft missiles are there, and they're not quite sure whether they're admitting that they are, and I quote, limited and necessary self-defence facilities.
Mm. They don't actually say who's attacking them, which is, you know, perhaps a little hiatus in the argument. Could be anyone.
Vietnam could come after them at a moment's notice.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that probably if we sort of pull back a little and look at what's happening kind of in this multidimensional chess game, it becomes a little more intelligible. Barack Obama has just entertained 10 ASEAN leaders in Sunnylands, California, in which he tried to get ASEAN once again to step up as a body to China over the South China Sea. It was discussed. It didn't get into any final statement. And the problem with ASEAN is that it works by consensus, and Laos and Cambodia can always be sat on by China and stop the consensus going very far. Nevertheless, ASEAN does have a kind of framework vis-a-vis the South China Sea, which is that, you know, there should be a code of conduct so that it doesn't get too tense, and it should all be resolved legally, and that means the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which China really doesn't have a hope of winning at. You know, if you look at what that convention, how that convention would parcel up the South China Sea, it certainly doesn't give it all to China. So China, a party to the convention, does not want to go to arbitration. Meanwhile, the Philippines is taking China to arbitration in The Hague. China's refusing to recognize the case, but at the same time writing a defense and publishing a defense of the Philippines case. So there's a lot of gesture politics going on. And I would suggest that the other thing that China was trying to make a point about is the, if you recall, after the Korean missile test, the United States proposed putting anti-ballistic missiles into South Korea, missile defense into South Korea and into Japan. China does not like that. And so I think there's a lot of kind of elbowing and jockeying and China going on creating kind of really immutable facts. You know, we have an island here, we have military installations here, this is part of our terrestrial administration, and dislodge us if you can. And of course, nobody will.
James, to look at the same thing, I guess, from America's perspective, the U.S. Pacific Command has, in reaction to this, said it will step up what it calls freedom of navigation operations, which in practice amounts to, you know, sailing big warships around the vicinity just to demonstrate that they can. How actually important are those?
Well, I mean, from a PR exercise, it's very important that the United States is seen to be maintaining its presence in that part of the world and not being seen to be pushed out of the region by any regional players, least of all China. I mean, you know, we've heard an awful lot over the last 8 years under the Obama administration about the famed Pacific pivot, and also hearing how it's not targeted at anybody. Wink, wink. So the idea that somehow they could possibly be squeezed out of that area at this point, especially when you consider, you know, as we've discussed before, the idea that the Americans are busy putting, you know, military installations into your own beloved Australia, you know, with this idea of trying to firm up their military commitment in that part of the world, possibly, would be very problematic. However, it's also important to remember that, and we were discussing this before we came on air, the idea that we are in an American political season at this point. And if you look back through the last year of any American president, you know, they do try to keep things quiet and not get involved militarily or start a new operation or want to get actively involved anywhere on the basis that, you know, they are preparing to hand over power and there will be a transfer. So you don't want to give the incumbent, the new American president, too much of a headache. So I think that, you know, if you are Putin, if you are the Chinese leadership, it's a good time to be rattling sabers, because there's a good to fair chance that you'll get a relatively negligible response from Washington.
Isabel, this is this deployment of this anti-aircraft battery, it's kind of a piece of, with, as far as I can tell at least, with China's general behaviour over the last few years. It's sort of small build-ups. It's small, needling, irritating provocations. Nothing really that in and of itself warrants enough for anybody to take a big slap at them over. It's, you know, it's fairly understandable and coherent what they're doing, but how cleverly calibrated do you think it is? I guess, what are the chances of either them overdoing it or somebody else overreacting to it?
Well, I think that the chances of them drifting into an armed conflict with the United States by accident are pretty slender. I mean, they could. You remember that a Chinese shock jock brought down an American spy plane some years ago.
2000,
and took them a while to get it back. And there was a lot of tension over that. But the parties that are most likely to respond with, again, small-scale spats, it's really Vietnam. I mean, they have, after all, fought twice over these islands, once in 1974 and once in 1988. Vietnam lost both times. But there's an awful lot of low-level aggression. So, you know, sinking of fishing boats, you know, kind of, and customs boats, smaller craft, not the military stuff. I think where you might get a problem would be with aircraft. I mean, and it seems quite likely that China might declare, again, without previously announcing it, another air identification zone, you know, which they did in the East China Sea and got everybody cross. But unless they actually shoot down a plane, and that takes serious carelessness, I think we're probably all right from that respect. But what will happen is that China will slowly and steadily, you know, simply create an unmovable situation in which it is sitting on top of built-up islands with military bases, despite Xi Jinping having promised Obama last year in Washington that he wouldn't militarize the South China Sea. And actually, short of, you know, a kind of resisted landing on one of these islands, how are you ever to get them off?
James, do you get the sense, you mentioned there the pivot to Asia sort mm-hmm. of, or Pacific pivot or whatever it was called, announced with great fanfare by Barack Obama. Is there any sense that America has in its head any fixed idea of what a red line is in the South China Sea, beyond which China may not actually cross without fairly serious consequences?
Well, I think the wider question is, does it know what a red line is that it's going to adhere to, quite frankly, because we've seen this this statement come out of the White House before, and it's meant very little. I think one of the great challenges is that there is no great stomach in Washington, D.C. for war, quite frankly, anywhere, despite what certain people might say about saber-rattling Republicans, quite frankly. There is a sense to which I think you've got a combat fatigue in the U.S., and it certainly has no great intention, desire, or willing ability, quite frankly, to take the battle to China. I'd follow on from Isabel's lucid points with regards to the risks in that part of the world. One of the problems we see, actually, is the amount of times in which maritime incidents have been utilized exacerbate a wider war. So the idea of bringing naval vessels as well as aircraft together in close proximity is a major problem. And of course, you rightly referred to the downing of the U.S. aircraft. It was actually in 2001, because it was one of the great first problems that George W. Bush had to face when he was an incoming president. So it'll be interesting to see how the incrementalism that you rightly refer to continues on into the new year, and the extent to which the Chinese leadership might seek to test the mettle of whoever the new American president is, especially if that American president had to be a female.
I think James is absolutely right that murky maritime incidents have been the pretext for further mm-hmm. conflict, yep. but only when further conflict is sought. Mm-hmm. And I think in this instance, you know, look at what's happening elsewhere. There is no appetite.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Isabel Hilton and James Boyce. Coming up next, gay marriage, which is a thing we're still talking about in 2016, apparently.
Monocle's unrivaled network of editors and correspondents around the world bring you a brilliant new collection of books, the Monocle Travel Guides. And the series kicks off with London and with New York City. New York used to be such an easy city to crack for the visitor, but now its focus has fractured and shifted. Why not let Monocle help you to navigate?
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Monocle has had a bureau in New York since its launch in 2007, and our travel guide is a celebration of all that we know and love about this place. We put together a list of the finest places and experiences the Big Apple has to offer, be it a cozy stay at the Cosby Street Hotel, a late drink in a classic bar like King Cole in Midtown, or a top-notch fuss-free trim at Cheez In Brooklyn. Let us take you beyond the obvious to reveal the hidden spots New York has to offer. Published by Gestalten, these books are for people who want to get the most out of their stay, however short, and feel like locals rather than tourists. So pick up the Monocle Travel Guide to New York in Monocle shops, at monocle.com, and in all good bookstores. The Monocle Travel Guides. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
And you're welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me, Isabel Hilton and James Boyce. Now, next tonight, Italy's journey towards joining that enlightened but depressingly meagre cohort of countries which have ceased instructing their citizens in whom they may and may not marry appears to have stalled. A bill that would have permitted civil unions has stalled in the country's parliament, ostensibly until next week, quite possibly until hell freezes. It leaves Italy at odds with most of the European Union and reminds of the power that tradition and or the church still wield in that country. James, is this just, obviously, is it just the Catholicism thing where Italy is concerned? Because Ireland, Spain, Portugal, France, all on board at this point. Are there other factors in play in Italy?
Well, it's difficult to ascertain exactly. At the moment, obviously, this has not been completely dropped, and as you rightly point out, just kicked into the relatively long grass until next week. We'll see what transpires at that point. But clearly, you know, when you've seen other Catholic countries come on board with this and move this forward, and when you see that this is no longer a subject which is up for debate within the Republican nomination, for example, in the US, then you have to ask the question about what is exactly is going on in Italy at this point, which means means that they are staying so unenlightened, as you rightly pointed out earlier on, in the year 2016.
Isabel, the European Court of Human Rights found against Italy on this matter last July. Is there anything that the rest of the EU can or should do to try and enforce that judgment, or does that just have a habit of entrenching divisions further or making the EU look ridiculous when Italy ignores it?
Well, there has been a long tradition, actually, of Italy longing for the EU to come in and sort out a problem which is not solvable, given the kind of normal chaos of Italian politics. And this may be a case, not so much, I think, for the EU, because I think it would be quite tricky to come in and solve that. But you might find in Italy, as we found in Ireland, rather to everybody's surprise, that the people were way ahead of the politicians on this one. And it could be the kind of issue which politicians are afraid to embrace for a misguided fear of popular reaction. I mean, Ireland was a surprise. They did it by plebiscite.
It was extraordinary. And there were those joyous scenes of thousands of Irish citizens flying home just to vote yes.
Indeed. And it's quite possible that Italy, I think, would adopt the same position. But you've got very entrenched right-wing and heavily traditionalist political forces, which will block it at the political level. It just could be that the people could unblock it.
I mean, obviously, Italy is kind of a special case where its relationship with the Catholic Church is concerned. It houses the Vatican City, mm-hmm. though that is obviously a separate sovereign state. Reports about this have pointed out that the Pope and indeed the Vatican haven't commented publicly. They don't really need to, though, do they, James? And is it possible to tell at this point how much power politically the Catholic? I mean, obviously, the Catholic Church wields immense cultural mm-hmm. power in Italy. Is it possible to tell how much power it wields politically now? Especially, I guess, given what we now have a fairly long tradition of not Italian popes.
Yes, sure. I think one would have to really sort of, be far more of an expert upon Vatican affairs to offer a really nuanced answer with regard to that. But I think that when you look at the silence that's coming out of the Vatican, and when you also consider, you know, the idea that this is not a country which is dominated by just one or two strong political parties and therefore able to give a particular lead, but is, you know, dominated by, you know, great factions and this idea of ludicrously large coalition governments with the classic north-south divide between, the urban and the rural, the conservative and the less conservative regions. You know, it's a nation which is so diverse that the idea of trying to provide leadership of the like which you could get in many other mainstream European countries is perhaps somewhat lacking. And so the power of the church is perhaps one of the key determining impacts at this point. But when you consider how progressive this Pope is apparently meant to be, it's surprising perhaps that there is not more of a lead coming out at this time, I would have thought.
It's bizarre, however, that the question of stepchildren, the adoption of stepchildren, seems to be a key point in this
argument,
which I don't recall being a key point in when this issue came up anywhere else.
I have read about this issue back and forwards, and I fail to understand what the problem actually is.
It seems to be a fear that adopting stepchildren will lead straight to surrogacy, and which is apparently a road to hell in Italy. But it's an odd deviation, I suppose, from the way this argument is normally covered, which is just that homosexuality is a sin in the eyes of God, or whatever you choose to argue.
Okay, well, let's move along to a sort of a sports story, because as football fans will already be aware, something extraordinary occurred during last night's Europa League match between Fenerbahce and Lokomotiv Moscow, which is to say that something happened during a Europa League match which was in some respect noteworthy. After the game, in which the Istanbul-based team knocked over their visitors 2-0, Lokomotiv midfielder Dmitry Tarasov removed his club colours to reveal a vest emblazoned with President Vladimir Putin above the perplexing caption, "The Most Polite President." James, the background here, obviously, Turkish-Russian tensions following Turkey shooting down a Russian Su-24 in November, Turkey and Russia at each other's throats on all sorts of fronts. Is there actually anything going on here beyond really daft young man does something daft?
in football, you know, I mean, quite frankly,
what are the chances?
What are the chances? You know, I mean, I've actually, you know, I grew up watching and loving football in this country, and I've just given up on it as a sport, quite frankly, for various reasons. But here we are, you know, it wouldn't be the first time that an overpaid, pampered sports star with a faint grasp upon international relations or any subject, quite frankly, has revealed an undershirt to suggest something controversial or provocative, and will get a slap on the wrist and a fine, which to us sounds like a fortune, but to them is, you know, 24 hours worth of pay, quite frankly.
We should note that his own club, as well as football authorities, are all in default unacceptable mode, though, frankly, it's not clear to me why this is much worse than wearing a club jumper sponsored by Qatar or Gazprom or somebody. Yeah. Isabel, why does it seem so completely unimaginable that you would see a British or French or German footballer doing the equivalent, you know, whipping off their shirt to reveal
a picture of David Cameron
or Francois Hollande or Angela Merkel?
Let me just think about that for a second, Andrew.
That would make the game far more engaging, wouldn't it?
Listen, I'm a bit of a football-free zone, but I agree that, you know, the notion that there is a higher political significance to this, beyond the fact that I'm sure Putin is delighted at this display of you know, ardent nationalism, particularly calling him the most polite. I want one of those T-shirts. You know, Putin, the most polite president.
I am sure if you venture to any market stall in Moscow or St. Petersburg tomorrow, those are going to be a hot item. James, more seriously, some suggestions have been made that Turkish and Russian clubs should perhaps be kept apart now, and even that the national sides should be separated during Euro 2016. Yeah. Is that smart? Because the other thing is, where do you stop once you start down that route?
Absolutely. I mean, let's be honest about it. We've had international teams continue to play one another during the Cold War, which was far more dangerous than we have at this point. And the whole point about sport, surely, is to bring people together in a friendly, acrimonious, free zone, etc., 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 whereupon the teams play very peacefully and the fans, you know, basically stone each other on the terraces, effectively, and run amok throughout city centres across the continent. It would be lovely to think that, these two teams could compete quite peacefully. And, of course, that is the way things should be done. But we have, of course, seen sport hijacked time and time again, not only in football, but, of course, the Olympics with the famous boycotts in 80 and 84.
Well, finally tonight, then, we should look to New York, where property developers are hovering at the news that the city's Landmarks Preservation Commission is or was taking a long, hard look at 95 properties currently occupying ground which could be consumed by riotously overpriced identikit faux luxury apartments. These properties include the IRT powerhouse in Manhattan and the famous Pepsi sign overlooking the East River in Queens. Isabel, when does a building become a landmark? I was thinking of that great line uttered by Noah Cross in Chinatown that politicians, whores and ugly buildings all get respectable if they last long enough.
Well, gosh, I think you've just defined it, haven't you? although, and of course, New York, you know, has committed some major crimes in this respect, the demolition of Penn Station being the most notorious one. I have to say that I don't feel particularly attached to any of the buildings on this list, but no doubt that is my my philistinism. And I think that perhaps the more serious point is that you've got a very, you know, dynamic city, and as we find in London, it's not so much the one building, it's what happens to the neighbourhood when you take out, it's a bit like a kind of gap in your teeth, and you stick a very large, you know, different style of building in there, and the whole coherence of the street or the neighbourhood begins to decline. So, you know, I kind of would personally regret the loss of character of the neighbourhood that rather than of an individual building.
But James, are there hard and fast rules, or do these things always have to be case by case?
Well, to be honest, a lot of these cases often only survive because of the groundwork of a particular individual. I mean, a classic case would be Grand Central Station, which many listeners might not believe was actually scheduled for demolition at one point. And one of the main reasons it survived was because of the ardent protestations of the former First Lady, Jackie Kennedy, to whom there is a plaque now in Grand Central Station, basically saying this building is still here because of the work of the former First Lady. So if you've not got someone high profile behind it, you know, you can lose landmarks like Penn Station. So it's important to recognise that there is a lot of domestic politics at play here, I think.
We will have to leave it there. James Boyes and Isabel Hilton, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all for today's episode of Midori House. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Ida Mae Griffiths and Yasmin Omar. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. For the next half hour, there's music at 1900 hours. Daniel Giacopelli follows with The Entrepreneurs. And we'll have more on the day's main stories with The Monocle Daily, hosted by me as well at 2200 here in London. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, from me, Andrew Muller, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.